This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
What we want to do tonight is ask you first perhaps to go back to a period that has gone, that was full of excitement, the 60s in Philadelphia, and the way you see the evolution of, say, curating art and curating shows in Philadelphia.
We're here to talk about the 60s, and in fact our gallery opened in 1960, so it's precisely on the button. But to put it in perspective, that time might have been the high point for American art galleries, and maybe for art galleries in general. I say that for this reason. From, to use Danto's scheme, from Manet to summer of 64, Warhol show, the subject of art was art, color, painting, line, not politics, not sociology, not ecology. It was very much art for art's sake, the Moritz, Moses Mendelssohn approach to art. Galleries at that time then could house the works that were being made. Works were made of a size and of material, painting, sculpture, graphics of different kinds, intended for people's private houses. You could carry them. You could put them in the back of the station wagon, make a show. Furthermore, almost all the commerce of art was through galleries. And that has changed. Just think of the day. Look, see what's on the television screen. You can't put a six-day festival in your living room, and you don't want all those pig entrails in your living room, probably. The commerce of art today is in large part, in many fields, not Charles, perhaps, but in many fields, the auction houses are dominating factors, which they were not in the past. And the art that's being made is certainly not the it's not formalism in art. It's concerned with social, political, and similar issues, which bring the artist into a different field from showing things on the walls of your living room. So the 1960s, in many ways, may have been optimal for the traditional art gallery. Although, as I said, a field like John's, which took off after that, that's certainly not the case.
It was a wonderful time to have a gallery, starting in 1960. There was a very gentle and personal relationship, we say, between our gallery and galleries in New York. You dealt with the owner of the gallery in New York. We were permitted in the back room so that we could pre-select, at least according to our eye, the best work that was available of the artist. People like Nevelson, Lipschitz, Calder, Mary Frank, Beverly Pepper, George, Ricky, Marisol, Samarister, George Siegel, would come to Philadelphia and come to our openings and meet our clients. Our clients became our friends and became friends with each other. And, of course, then that all fed on each other. They learned from each other. They learned from us. We learned from them. And the gallery was, in a little way, a kind of educational institute. Place. Because they would come and we would talk, and hopefully what we taught them to do was to learn to see, to look at a painting, analyze it very a la Barnes Foundation, I must admit. But it was a very personal relationship.
Is that your experience, John?
My experience in the 60s was as a student. I was a student at the University of the Arts, which was then called PCA. And we were all kind of on a rather radical, what we thought was very radical at the time, kind of bent. And it was generated by a single person who was involved in the art world then, a man by the name of Jim McWilliams. And Jim McWilliams had come to the University of the Arts as a head of the graphics department. And the first thing that he did was to throw out all the type and had students graffiti the inside of the graphics studio. The school was just beside themselves. But one of the things that he did, and this was in 63, of course, was the Warhol exhibit at ICA. 65, was it? Okay. Thinking back.
I'll be the historian who will keep you honest.
All right, 65. So McWilliams was here at that time. We were involved in his classes with sort of impromptu performances with Charlotte Moorman, and Nam June Paik would come down, and we would make films with Nam June Paik. All of that sort of, to me, was what was really exciting in the 60s. He created a class for a group of students that were sort of selected for the class. It was called Experiments in Communication. And our senior project was the Museum of Merchandise, which was at the Jewish Y, which was a very sort of exciting place to see sort of cutting-edge art projects. And I credit, again, four people in Philadelphia that were involved with that, that whole experience. And it was Audrey Sable, A.C. Woljan, Joan Crone, and Janet Carden. And they were very much a part of this project called the Museum of Merchandise, which, the storefront was designed by Christo, and our senior sculpture class built that storefront and were involved with the what products went into the store from Andy Warhol and Lichtenstein, and sort of all of the big, exciting artists of that mid-60s period of time. Billy L. Benson designed costumes. There was a fashion show. Christo designed the wedding dress, which was a big, huge bundle of silk with silk ropes. The thing was all performed by gymnasts in the gym at the Jewish Y. And that to me was sort of like the spirit of what was happening in Philadelphia at that time. And the galleries I remember going to Hope and Paul's gallery and seeing the David Smith show, and I'm just kind of blown away by that. And then there was the gallery that was part of the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, which the name escapes me now, but it was over on Chestnut Street in the 1800 block, above the club. The Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts had a dining club. And Peel House Galleries. And they always had very interesting shows there. I mean, they had some very early self-taught shows. They had an Elijah Pierce show and a Justin McCarthy show. And it was the first place where I saw the Chicago Images. ICA was the first place. But they had a show for Roger Brown in the early 70s. And so those were the sort of the two galleries where you could expect to see exciting things. There weren't that many galleries in town. How many did you?
There were very few.
Very few. I mean, Janet's gallery was really, kind of a mess at that time.
Because there were two or three galleries that mostly showed Philadelphia.
Right.
People had made a point.
But in terms of being out, sort of looking at the larger art world, there really weren't that many.
It was quite barren.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a question I'd like to ask all of you. This link between the local and, let's say, New York or the international, was that a problem then, or you seem to have solved it at that time?
I think that one of the things that I found to be most lacking in Philadelphia in terms of the art scene was that the museum was not that supportive of contemporary art. And I think that the only places that you really did see it were places like at Hope and Paul's, or at the Jewish Y, or at ICA. But the Philadelphia Museum was still...
Let me jump in here and add something to the background of the demographics. I arrived in Philadelphia in 1965 as a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania in September 65, and within a week that Andy Warhol show opened. And here
I was with, you know, a BA in art history, and where I did know about pop art, I was in New York. I had some, but I was a rarefied, I mean, they don't call it the Ivory Tower for nothing. And even though I was an undergraduate in New York, I didn't have an engaged sense of the art world. Came to Philadelphia, and within weeks, there at the ICA, which was in, the show was mounted in the Furness Library, was one of the more extraordinary events of the 60s, and that it happened in Philadelphia is certainly noteworthy. The paintings were taken down from the walls for the opening. Such was the crush of people. And in fact, Warhol himself, who came, and then he and his entourage had to repair to a stairway so that the other to avoid being overrun by the crowd, at that moment understood that they were the art. It was quite an extraordinary thing. And I remember standing after days after the opening, when the paintings were back on the wall, looking at these paintings of with a mechanical silkscreen process, looking at electric chairs and car accidents with bodies fallen out of the crashed cars, and being incredibly moved and understanding that a revolution was taking place, had taken place, that I was catching up with it and had jumped right into it. Having said this, by way of explaining something of my background, I want to comment on the demographics of the Philadelphia art world. The Philadelphia Museum of Art was its own ivory tower, dedicated to excellence. Contemporary art had very little to do with their understanding what was fine about fine art. And there were a group of energetic, largely women of means who had the time and the interest to realize, to pick up and understand that there was change afoot in the early 1960s art world. Today, their entrance onto the board of the Philadelphia Museum of Art would be without question, just a matter of course. But there were factors in the early 60s that prevented them gaining any headway. Anti-Semitism, custom, new attitudes of distrust about newcomers, whatever it was. They did not get on the board to help affect the change there. And so the Philadelphia Museum was really lagging behind the explosion of the contemporary art world for a long time. These energetic women, named by John, put their energy into the Arts Council at the Jewish Y. And that's why the first show of pop art anywhere outside of a commercial gallery in New York was held in Philadelphia in 1962, preceding the Museum of Merchandise that John was just telling you about. So this was, and it was just an extraordinary event. At just about that time, the faculty, the art faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, realized that there should be an Institute of Contemporary Art. And so one was founded, and the first part-time director was a woman by the name of T. Grace Sharpless, who we know today as T. Grace Atkinson, because she left the art world and made a name for herself as a activist, feminist lesbian. Anyway, back to the ICA. She was the first director. They brought in Sam Green in 65 as its first full-time director. And so the dynamics began to change because people who were interested in contemporary art who could not get any headway at the Philadelphia Museum began to put energy into the ICA, and it quickened the pace. And that's a bit of my take on it. I myself am writing a biography of an art dealer who opened a gallery in New York in 1960. So I tend to know a bit more about the gallery scene in New York than in Philadelphia at that moment.
I think ICA wasn't just, it wasn't just that it was a phenomenon in Philadelphia. It was a phenomenon, period. I mean, it was one of the most highly regarded and sought after venues for a show of artists of that time period. I think that they instantly established this position in the art world that everybody respected because they were really.
It was a vacuum, John. It formed in '64, and we were on the original board of it. At that time, the museums in Philadelphia, not just the Philadelphia Museum of Art, but the Pennsylvania Academy and the others, had a stipulation not to show work by living artists. So there was a great gap available for a private gallery or for the ICA. There was a real, so that the Robert Indiana show, the David Smith show, the Warhol show, these were major shows at the ICA. Since then, the situation is utterly different, and the ICA has a different role. But at that time, it was the only, and you know, it's not a Penn institution. It's a private institution that has an arrangement with Penn to get certain property benefits here, in return for which the students have some access. But it's not a Penn institution. It was private individuals. And there was a considerable amount of stress at that time between the two elements.
Two pivotal people we haven't mentioned, I think, are Marion Locks, who had a different approach. She supported local artists, and that was and did a marvelous, really monumental job of paying attention to local artists, fostering them, filling a whole gap that was quite necessary. Helen Drutt, who is the doyenne of craft, and then the Please Touch Museum, which was established, founded, nurtured, loved. by a woman.
In what year was that founded?
We started we opened in 76 saying we're not a bicentennial museum. We get any money from bicentennial. But we got started organizing in 75. So, 30 years.
Nevertheless, in 69, the PMA had the Duchamp étant donné, and of course Duchamp just died, since it was in his will that it would be a posthumous piece. But then, at least for later viewers, it's often felt that the PMA is a sort of contemporary art institution. Would you date it from that moment?
I've always thought that Duchamp left the work to the Philadelphia Museum because of a certain frisson, because it was not, you know, that it had something to kind of grit against rather than that this was going to be the support of open arms.
Okay, as a joke against.
In a way,
yes.
I've always thought that.
But did not Anne d'Arnoncourt do a book on Duchamp?
Oh, yes. I mean, that.
But she wasn't even here yet.
She came earlier. As an assistant curator, but I can't remember when, and then left and went to Chicago and came back with her husband, Joe Rischel. But there was an earlier time when she and Kippy Stroud, who was then involved with Prince in Progress, and I believe this is 68, it has to be 69 because I'm measuring it against events in my own life. So yes, it was in the late 60s that Anne was brought in, and she did a very interesting group show that involved the artist Jess, who I saw for the first time here in Philadelphia in her show, and was Janet Fish in that show? She had some interesting choices, and she was really the first curator that I remember who really was genuinely interested in the work of living artists.
It was changing. By 70, the museums had changed their policy. so I couldn't date it. But they were changing.
We know that the Arenbergs were looking around to put their collection, and it wasn't easy. From what I read in Duchamp's biography, there were many failed attempts in other places, L.A., Chicago, and it was finally Philadelphia. It may be, you would suggest to me that it's pure chance that it was a PMA in a way.
No, I don't think it's chance. I mean, I think there were some of his other work here, but I think he liked the idea of the conservatism.
Shocking the conservatives in Philadelphia. Yeah, but
well, for instance, Calder, who's starting now to be identified with Philadelphia. Mm. And maybe there'll be a Calder Museum.
Right.
But the big Calder mobile in the Philadelphia Museum, the ghost, Philadelphia Museum was probably the last major museum in the country to have a Calder. So they were not out there beating the bushes for native son, far from it.
And since we talk about local institutions, most of you have been connected with the Barnes. Could one say that in the 60s the presence of the Barnes was felt in Philadelphia? Was there, or was it just a group of people who would go to the suburbs and then come back illuminated? How do you see that institution, strange institution?
For us, it was our introduction into the world of art. We were into music until that time. But I was there in 54 and 5, and then opened 56 and 7, and that's why we opened a gallery.
Because of the Barnes? Mm-hmm. The Barnes was a sort of model?
No, I mean, that's where we got what education we got. Mm-hmm. And that's where we developed a liking, love, for the kind of art that indeed we did, which was a very definite type of art, and very old-fashioned now, but the kind of art and the formalist approach to art was the way we were raised, and insofar as our gallery had clients and influenced them, to that extent, it was a Barnes foundation, style, technique.
But you showed Anselm Kiefer.
Well, the Kiefer came later.
Later in your role.
Born in,
We didn't, except for very few, like Milton Avery or Jacques Lipschitz, we didn't show Renoir or Cézanne or Matisse.
We'd have loved to.
But we're post World War II.
Right.
But our taste, our eyes were developed.
Right.
There. I mean, a standard of excellence
was
developed.
What I mean is that maybe there are two things that can be distinguished. First is a formalist approach to art, but it can be applied to Warhol or to very radical projects, and then the choices you develop, they may not be exactly, you know, identical, as you said, to the choices of Barnes himself, some of which are questionable for us today, but others are not.
We weren't formally wed to it. For instance, the Barnes Foundation has really know it. The last purchase was 54, but in the Barnes collection. But you don't find abstract expressionists in the Barnes Foundation, and yet we had them in the gallery insofar as we were able to. So that we weren't completely subservient to it.
Is that your impression, Judith, that the Barnes, in a way, fostered a certain type of approach?
It's an interesting thing to think about. First, I think the Barnes education taught people to see and whether that led to a certain flavor to the Philadelphia art world. I can't say. I've been sitting here thinking about the history of the one institution that I do know fairly well, which is the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, and just it might be helpful to just say a few sentences about that's the history. I mean, it was founded in 1805 to support the art of contemporary artists. So it was founded really as to support contemporary art. But as the moving finger of history goes on, everybody that they were supporting became historic. In 1920 and 21 and 23, there were three pioneering shows where almost in advance of, certainly in advance of the Metropolitan Museum in New York and in any other established museum, the Academy showed contemporary art with a vengeance, having large group shows, the third of which was, of course, the one time that Barnes ever lent his collection, a rather radical selection of Soutine and Jawlensky and other painters of an expressionist stripe that he had just bought in Paris and had shipped directly to the Academy. But there were, Picasso and Mary Cassatt and any number of, she would have been dead by then, but anyway, there were many contemporary artists who showed in these series of three shows, which were taken up after the First World War as a way of helping the Academy students reconnect to the European art world that had been, unreachable for the duration of the war. But in a way, it just pushed it too far, and the administration at the Academy kind of closed the door after the Barnes show of 23. And so they slept peacefully through pretty much all of the major movements of the mid-century, letting abstract expressionism kind of float away, that if they closed their eyes tightly enough, it would just go away. In the first director who really began, said, excuse me, there's been something going on here, was none other than Tom Armstrong, who was for 2 years director of the Pennsylvania Academy before he went on to the Whitney Museum, where he stayed for many years making his career. But he initiated a show, I think, in 1972 with Italo Scanga and several other artists who were not just contemporary, but rather avant-garde. Scanga had potatoes that sprouted and rotted in the galleries, and oleiferous spices that were distributed around the Academy. And that really started the movement in that institution. But for many, many years, it was Rip Van Winkle.
And just to pull it all the way around, Italo Scanga was also the first artist to bring self-taught artist to Pennsylvania by creating a one-person show for Joseph Yocum in 1967, I believe. And then they also, I think, fed into what became a very important show at IC called Spirit of the Comics, which was the first sort of exposure in Philadelphia to the Harry Who and what was happening out in other parts of the world. And of course, that connection was very important to Philadelphia because Anne Darnicourt, when she came back to Philadelphia from Chicago, brought the whole sort of Chicago Imagist tradition into the museum. And early on, they started adding some of those people. But it was this dialogue that was going on between Philadelphia and cities other than New York, and what else was out there that people were using and for inspiration. And so Philadelphia became a very early focus point for self-taught art, and how that kind of was brought about was again very much part of what was happening in Philadelphia and made it, I think, very unique.
But in that, do you see as well this connection with the Barnes that after all?
I don't think so. I think it's really kind of almost it's a connection to the Barnes in a reverse sort of way. It was sort of like looking away from that in a sense that I think I found that there were a lot of people who were decidedly not interested in the Barnes. Mm-hmm. They were interested in looking at other sources of information.
Right.
And almost were anti-Barnes. I think there was a very strong kind of anti-Barnes movement in the city, you know, where it had been such a powerful influence in terms of how people were educated that, you know, it was something that, you know, I caught myself amongst them. You know, people who didn't involve themselves in the bards and, you know, were absolutely, you know, absolutely sort of, I mean, it was a long time before I warmed up to the Barnes Foundation.
As any educational institution, it can take a collector or a student just so far, can influence you for one way or the other, but then after a while you have to stand on your own 2 feet and read and look and look and look and you're saturated with looking. And then you do that, take that first step and buy something, that agonizing process of buying something. And that's the real learning experience. You see a lot of work and you decide, that's for me. And then you learn from it. You might not want to keep it, but then you learn why you don't want to keep it. Or you learn why you want to keep it. And that's the learning process.
Which leads me maybe to the question of economics and the public. What I've often heard was that in Philadelphia there wasn't really an audience because there were not many collectors. And I wanted to ask you, since you have that first-hand experience, is that a myth? Is it true?
I think there are a lot of collectors. I don't necessarily think that they always support the places that bring art into Philadelphia. It was my experience that long ago, when I first started working at the gallery, that we needed to expand our base. And that was why we got involved with doing the large art fairs. And at this point, I'd say that probably 95% of all of our clients are from places other than Philadelphia. But then again, we show a very, you know, we were showing a very focused material, so we had to go out and, you know, let people know what we were doing. And, you know, there was the collectors of self-taught art were few and far between, so you couldn't expect to find them all in Philadelphia. But I think that everybody has had this experience, and every Philadelphia dealer has had this experience, where we have consigned things to New York that Philadelphia collectors have bought from the gallery in New York. Just by believing, and it's not just a Philadelphia thing. You talk to any other dealer in a city other than New York, and they will tell you that their major clients always feel that they're getting a better piece if they buy it in New York. And it could have been something that...
We found it a double-edged sword. On the one hand, exactly as John says, your client could go to New York in 2 hours, and it's certainly more glamorous, and he's going to see a lot more material and feel that he'd gone to the metropolis and was in. On the other, that's the disadvantage. The advantage was we could go up to New York, which was the greatest collection of art material in the world, and take anything we want at home. Every gallery in New York would let us take things on consignment back to Philadelphia. Really? So that...
Is that mostly the way you work?
Completely.
Completely by consignment?
Completely.
I see.
We split commissions with the gallery in New York so that our client wasn't paying more. Mm-hmm. They were getting whatever benefit came from our filtering the material, and some of them thought they were treated more cordially. But we could go and bring any, so that's the good part. All the material in the world was in New York available to us.
Didn't you grow your collectors, though? I mean, through and helping to educate their eyes, and so that if there weren't that many collectors to begin with, you nurtured them and brought them along.
In those years, most probably of the collections that were forming in Philadelphia were being formed with respect to our taste, for better or for worse. Now, that didn't last, but at first, after a while, people then are going to go off on their own and develop their own tastes and their own judgment. You can't keep them. It's like raising your children. At a certain point, they're going to take off. They should. If you've done a good job, they'll take off.
that they also would come back.
Yeah, they're very loyal. The people who
You start and educate generally are stay pretty loyal to you as because you become friends with them mostly. And you know, and you begin not only do they know what you're going to show them, but you begin to really understand what they're going to respond to. And you know, and when you find something, you go, this is so-and-so's, this is, I know exactly where they're going to hang this picture. Mm-hmm. And you get it for them, and they appreciate that. Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot of collectors that you have that relationship with. So, I mean, there's a, you know, but we all have our favorites in Philadelphia.
But you said that this came to an end in terms of...
No, I think they would go... they would try their wings, and some we would lose, and then some would realize that we really were able to bring the best things back for them.
Now, what I meant when I said it came to an end was, we started in 1960, but we didn't really care much for the art that was being done after the late 70s. Mm-hmm. So that our taste was our taste, and, mm-hmm. and the people that came to us, our clients, shared the same taste. Mm-hmm. It's a generational thing in part. And as new material, new types of art, new kinds of art were coming in, we were fading out, which is one reason why we closed the gallery. Okay. We only wanted to show the kinds of things that we really liked.
Okay.
And a change, generational change was happening.
And do you see, let's say, Philadelphia as a place where you would want to start a gallery again now? Or I'm thinking of the future now.
Start a gallery, a new gallery every sort of every season, I think. Actually, it's you know when we moved into our new space, which happened 2 years ago, it really became a great opportunity to kind of rethink the gallery and how we've changed, because we not only do your clients change, but you change as well. And so you know, we have definitely sort of changed the gallery, and we have still a passion for self-taught material, which I think has become part of very much a part of what's happening in the contemporary art world. But now I'm interested in what the response of contemporary artists are to that material, and those artists are people that I'm interested in showing. And a lot of them are, you know, 24-year-olds that just happen to be, you know, there happens to be a wonderful art scene that's evolving in Philadelphia, probably the strongest art scene that I've ever seen in this city as long as I've lived here, which is a long time. Longer than some people would like to admit. But I think right now it's a very, very exciting time. It has the same kind of energy that I felt when the Warhol show was happening at ICA. I mean, it's just, there's something happening here right now that's very unique.
If I were opening a gallery now, I'd be more toward John's area. It would be cross-cultural somewhat.
That's very much what I think a lot of galleries are looking in that direction. I mean, it's a big world out there. You know, we can't, you know, for many years, you know, galleries were just, you know, sort of Western, you know, whatever the Western sensibility was. Now it's like you go and you know, if you're not sort of looking at what's happening in China and Japan and South Africa, then you're just not really paying attention to the world. And it's all of those things have exciting things going on.
Yeah. I wouldn't open the kind of gallery we opened in 60. And those several institutions in the city that are sort of doing that or trying to, I don't think are doing anything very exciting.
You don't think it's very exciting?
No, I think the several galleries that are trying, there are a couple that are doing that today. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's setting the world on fire.
But there are some really exciting galleries in the city that are...
But I think it would be a different kind of gallery if I opened a gallery at all.
I would like to do another picture of Philadelphia because my study in Philadelphia is very strange. I was in 1961 in New York, beginning of the Chelsea Hotel, and I have a dealer. I did a lot of prints at that time. And my dealer, one day I was there, approached me somebody from Philadelphia. This is a true story. He said, you want to do a show in Philadelphia? And I came for the first time in 62 to Philadelphia and did a show, which I forgot. And was in the print club. Somebody was a collector, I don't remember the name, big collector of prints, and there was a curator of McNulty, the name of Philadelphia.
Neil McNulty.
I remember only his name. There was also a name of a collector of prints, big collector of prints.
Sig Grosser?
Yes, Sig Grosser, right. Mm-hmm. So I came for one night to Philadelphia. I don't remember where I see in which hotel. They give me a dinner, I did a show in 1962. I never come back to Philadelphia. I never saw a dinner. Then in 1978 or 79 or 80, I don't remember exactly, I was approached by Janet Cardone, who was the director of the ICA, because I was doing the art history pieces, which of course nobody knows in Philadelphia. And then I don't know if my dear or my, what reason happened, or she went away to be the director of the Museum of Craft in New York, I don't remember exactly why. Then I became a friend of her, and she came a lot to my career in New York. For my second time in Philadelphia, and at that time, because contemporary art was an important institution, respected, because I didn't show in America, but I showed in Europe a lot, and I wanted to do a show in the ICA because it was kosher. In the center, was an institution who was respected outside. Then my next approach to Philadelphia was that I stopped in the train to see John Margulis, who was the chair of Philadelphia Temple. And I met him in a symposium of art critic, international critics in Argentina with Bouillard and other people, and I liked his position, so he wrote my catalog for the Museum of Jerusalem. So I used to stop in Philadelphia and go to have lunch near the station with him, and he gave me the text, and I go back to New York. And then I came to Philadelphia by chance because my wife was in the PhD effect in the West of Pennsylvania. That was in 91. I never have any contact with Philadelphia for years, until 19, when did I meet you? In Arrowhead. When was it? 2000. I don't remember. We just, by chance, we walked in the street to the same restaurant, and I began to speak French with him, become friends, and the next week he came, and they gave me the conference. And my experience with Philadelphia, the only critic which I know in Philadelphia who came to my studio in the last 12 years is here present, is Julie Stein. I never got any dealer come to my studio, any collector, though I'm here for at least 12 years and I have a reputation which I think honestly is not bad. So I really am very, not respected, but very suspicious.
Suspicious.
In many sense. So I don't share your optimism. I think that it's a rational place, mainly. I think that we are trying to change that all together, that's why we are here. And I believe that there are good things in Philadelphia, and it's not the academy, by the way, in which I teach for many years. I see the possibility of Philadelphia in the way I think about art today. By the way, the dealers from New York come to Philadelphia to sell their work. I sold in Philadelphia very expensive work to dealers from New York, which are not my dealers. Which means that today a dealer is a dealer, but not a gallery anymore. If a guy in Philadelphia, which I don't like to show them, comes to my studio with a client and buys for thousands and thousands of dollars my work, that means how corrupt is the situation in their world today. That happens all the time. So I don't need to go to New York, even if you are well known, they will bring you the clients here. That's what happened with me. So I have a big studio in Philadelphia for 8,000 square feet downtown, and then I have a studio here, 2 houses. I don't need the dealers of Philadelphia. Because the dealer from New York will bring you the client. This is the situation of Philadelphia. Out of 2 guys, or 3, which I know, I never been in a gallery in Philadelphia.
Oswaldo, your story really is a story of affiliation, and that if you are not represented by a gallery in Philadelphia, there's no center to the art world in Philadelphia. Or query, is there a center? Because if you're not in a gallery, then your access to other artists could be through your teaching situation, but there is no natural place where people gather, where collectors see work, and so on.
I think that in the way I think about Philadelphia and what is positive about Philadelphia, I believe that in the, we are talking history, and I'm talking what I think is today. Philadelphia has the possibility to have a gallery. If you don't think in terms of making money with the gallery, and of course, if you think in terms of creating what was in the 60s, or the Solomon, or whatever, where the gallery, or Thibaut de Nage, who was my first dealer in America, people who are really interested to express a sensibility. Here you can get a wonderful space very cheap. You can do a program that you want, because you can do it. And you can survive in something else, like many galleries did in Europe. In the 60s, Conrad Fischer and Schmela, when they begin to show boys, when they begin to show, this is Philadelphia, the possibility to create an enormous interest in show art, which is not commercial, but you cannot do in New York, because you have to show it, I don't know, in Brooklyn. Philadelphia has this possibility, but nobody seems, I'm not talking about you, to explore this possibility, to create a gallery which is absolutely non-commercial, who can show, and believe me, you can bring here incredible artists, which are not interested.
Well, here is Slott.
That
and it
is slot.
It is,
yeah,
an
commercial
embodiment of the non-commercial space, but there have been others, and there will be others, but it's not a commercial gallery. So, people are normally in business to earn some sort of a profit. I mean,
Do you remember my non-commercial gallery?
Yes, I do. John and Ann Ullman ran a gallery on South Street.
OIC.
OIC, mm-hmm. And which stood for?
I have cannot remember what it stood for.
It gave over the space to the artist.
We paid the rent, and the artist was given the space for 6 weeks, and the deal was that they got it in hangable position, in a hangable situation, and they were to return it the same way. It was a really expensive 2 years, wasn't it, Anne?
And you didn't make any money on any...
There was no money to be made. Almost all of the shows were installation pieces. It cost us a tremendous amount of money when, somebody decided to make a water slough that had canvases with dyes and rerouted the water in the building and drilled a hole through the floor. And the next opening, there was a big dance party at the opening, and someone stepped through the hole because it hadn't been properly
you see
prepared.
Why I like oil on canvas, 3 feet by four.
It was quite a 2 year party event, but it was very expensive, and mm-hmm. Not one single artist ever returned the space to the condition it had been when they got it.
But there were some really
but it was great shows,
there
some
were
great
wonderful shows.
The Museum of Degenerate Art Show, which was a correspondence school installation exhibition.
And the Northwest Mounted
the Police. Was
yes.
The person.
I didn't believe it's possible to create a gallery. We are not a gallery who make it with other galleries, without alternative things. But it's possible, in my opinion, in this sense I'm optimistic, somebody young who want to open a space in Philadelphia to show work which are for sale at normal prices can create a situation where he can show art in Philadelphia and do a program which is absolutely contemporary and which is respected by all the colleagues. I still believe this is possible in Philadelphia. This is my opinion. I don't know.
I think it's really hard. I mean, I think it's not, having done, this sort of non-commercial experimental gallery and doing a regular for-profit gallery at the same time. It's really hard, and you end up getting, you feel very defeated in ways that it's hard to predict I think everybody feels, the artist maybe feels that they've put themselves out by putting up the show. The person who's in the dealer position has put themselves out by putting up the money, and the space and the time, that it takes. I mean, we were art dealers 7 days a week for 2 years. I think it's very hard to maintain the energy that it takes to do those kind of spaces, and I don't care whether it's Philadelphia or New York. it's very hard to maintain them financially unless you have set aside a certain amount of money that you're just willing to commit to the art, because the buying part of it isn't going to support it. And if it's a not-for-profit, then you're into a different situation. And I think, if you start out and say it's going to be a not-for-profit, organization, you can go out and raise money for it. That's one way of doing it. But I can tell you from experience, that it just, it doesn't work very well.
But isn't it always the same idea that, in a sense, you want to educate your public? So the means are different. And of course, when it is just canvas, it's probably not the same as when it is installation art or land art or mail art or all these electronic versions. But in the end, there is a certain process by which you hope that a certain public will understand that what you do is important and at least will invest some time, maybe not money, but time in coming. Don't you think that this hasn't changed, as it were?
Well, I think there's always a fresh crop of sort of idealists out there that are willing to go out. And, I mean, OIC wasn't the only gallery like it at its time. And what was the gallery that Maury Kerrigan first showed at? Down at?
She showed it at
Yeah, but this was before that. It was in Old City.
Oh, right. Yes, in Old City. Yeah.
It was the same time that I had OIC.
Mm-hmm.
So there were these galleries. They lasted, a year, 2 years. Now we've got a whole another group of them. I think the group right now is just as exciting as they were back then. I really think, you can commit 2 years to a project like that. Then somebody else has got to step in and sort of with new energy and new money and hopefully new artists. I think that Philadelphia has always, or certainly since we've been here, has always had a group of these galleries. When OIC closed, then Nexus opened. And, Nexus was a very vital place when it first opened. I mean, everybody kind of went there to see what was kind of going to be the next interesting young Philadelphia artist. And now it's, there's a whole group of them, 1026 and Base Camp and Vox Populi and, the ones that open for like 24 hours and are gone. But those are, there's sort of been as one closes, another one opens up. And I think it's certainly easy to do that in Philadelphia. You can usually find a space that's not too horribly expensive and a group of people that are, that have the energy to do it.
What was the energy? I agree with you. Hmm. But I remind you again that Conrad Fischer, the people who were doing the Great Galleries, offered to Stella and to any one of the American current rate a ticket in one work sold. And I don't see another way to create a kind of parallel movement at the situation which is today in the market. I believe, my perspective as an artist is small galleries with small budget, with small rent, who can maintain for a while and create really a situation in which you can survive and create an interesting space.
Some of the ways they survive, isn't it, by through secondary market? I mean, making money secondary market.
Yeah, that pays all of our bills. It always has. But now, most of the artists that you deal with want you to get them out and in circulation in the bigger art world. It really requires today doing 3 or 4 art fairs a year.
It's true.
I mean, we do, this last year we've done 5. And, it's a tremendously expensive way of doing, doing an art, and a horrible way to sell art. I mean, I hate it, but, there are great paybacks. We are now, conversant with the international scene, and we have, major curators who look at the work that we're showing, and one of our young artists that we just took on is going to have a one-person show at White Columns in June, which is a tremendous honor. selected by Matthew Higgs, who's a really respected international curator. So that's the payoff of, you know, doing Scope London and Scope Miami and the Basel Art Fair and all the fairs that we do. But I can tell you that it takes a lot away from our regular gallery in Philadelphia, because we're kind of constantly preparing for a fair. I mean, we're getting ready for Basel right now. It's like a mammoth task. I mean, the paperwork alone to do a fair in Basel is just daunting. I mean, you know, we're talking about this much paperwork and all of the taxes and the import forms. And I mean, it's just, you know, the things that you don't think about, but it consumes, you know, a huge amount of our staff's time.
The same amount of time they consume in art to create a catalog, a new group show, excuse me.
Exactly.
I have 1 week working with my assistant to prepare what the museum wants, information, photography, digital things. This is what I have been all my life.
Yeah, but we
this
do that.
This is what I'm going to do to the last day of
we
my life.
We do that so for our artists. We do all the photography and cataloging.
So what I say, it's okay. I understand, because it's true. But when you go to an art fair, an artist who goes to the art fair also has to do a lot of work. We are in a system, whatever I didn't create and you didn't create, in which we have this is our boat and our bed. And we can quit. Nobody has to be an artist. So if I accept to be an artist, I have to have this. If not, I can just not show anymore and say, okay. But if I want to show, the same way that you need to put all this for Basel, I have to put all the other things for Basel. Or prepare a drawing of 6 meters and pay for the drawing. This is part of the order. The question is, in which moment we are tired and we have to stop to do things. If I would be tired to do, and I'm 67, I would close and say, okay, I go to a place in Brazil and I just work to do my work.
But there's one thing in common that artists have and dealers have, which keeps them in the art world, and it's the love, because it's not the money. It can't be the money. No matter how successful, there's no real payoff, or there is for a very very few, and it is love, and that is at the heart of our shared experience of the art world, whether we are collectors or critics or dealers or artists.
But isn't it maybe easier to keep this love alive in a smaller place like Philadelphia than in a bigger place like New York, in which I think one perceives maybe too quickly the importance of fashion, you know, the new trends and money, and, you know, even the shift from Soho to Chelsea and all that.
And to Brooklyn, I think maybe because there's no longer is a New York, there are New
yes.
Yorks.
Yeah.
And there are, it has, that they it has split up because there's just so many people who are parts of it.
I think that's one of the reasons that we've seen this huge influx of young artists into Philadelphia too.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, Philadelphia is another New York. I mean, it's like there's a group of people here there. They spend lots of time, you know, traveling back and forth, and this is like not that much further than various parts of Brooklyn or Hoboken or wherever they can afford to live at this point in their career.
And still, excuse me, and still most artists like that will define success as having New York show, a New York deal, or New York exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So and even if we're here, you can certainly live and have space cheaper in Philadelphia, more easily in Philadelphia than in New York. But still, the goal is going to be to get there.
It's true. You know, there's one aspect of Philadelphia that we didn't make a reference to. I was in the 70s in Art in America that the sculptor Wade Saunders, who's actually about to have a show at the University of the Arts, he did a piece called The Philadelphia Triangle, in which he talked about, I think he began with Thomas Aikens, and he brought it up through various artists' careers, obviously referring to the Bermuda Triangle, because, you know, of artists who, you know, were known and then settled in Philadelphia or never left Philadelphia, and somehow great as they may have been, their careers kind of, you know, imploded on themselves because of either the insularity of Philadelphia or the it being not New York. So I just put that into the mix of our conversation.
But you think this is a thing of the past, or?
I don't know. Is it?
This is a question.
I think it's certainly breaking down. I think back in the early 70s that to be defined as successful, you basically had, if you were an artist in Philadelphia, you had to leave and you had to reestablish or establish yourself in New York with a New York gallery. And, you know, part of the problem that was created for artists who chose to stay in Philadelphia was, and we certainly experienced this with a number of artists who recorded by various New York galleries and then basically said, you have to live in New York. You have to be part of the social scene. We can't promote you if you're not. And, you know, promotion is what it's about. You know, so there were people that were in that strange position. I think that people were really forced to kind of make that decision, either leave or not, you know, become, not have the potential of becoming an art star. I think that has definitely changed. I think that many more of the artists who are, you know, the people that we are aware of now in New York, many more of them do not live in New York. You know, that it's a much more international experience, and certainly, you know, many of the artists who get, you know, are regularly shown in New York are from, God forbid, the West Coast.
They want to show in New York.
Yeah, but I mean, still, but now it's not required that you live in New York.
And
I mean, I think, you know, looking at somebody like Richard Diebenkorn, who went many, many, many years, well known on the West Coast before ever being shown in New York, or Ruchet, or, you know, any number of people who now are, you know, they live in California, they show in New York
or New Mexico, or, like, yeah, Bruce Nauman.
Yeah. Yeah. Lica lives in Buenos Aires, is represented by Peroni.
Right, or, you know,
Peroni showed him every year, and he's in Garibaldi.
And now I think that, you know, most of the magazines that you pick up, or most of the things that you see, you know, talk about the art scenes in other parts of the world. I mean, I think that the YBAs, for example, you know, sort of really shook everybody up. That suddenly, well, maybe London was the scene, and now maybe it's Berlin. You know, so it's like nobody's just committed to that you have to be in New York to be part of the international art scene. And I think it's really international is the key word now. You know, that it's not New York, it's what's happening internationally.
At least this is true in Europe. I'd say that you mentioned Berlin, but at least in France, if I know a little better, Paris is not the key anymore. And AG, who was here recently, reminded us that...
And by the way, Berlin has no mark. I just opened a show 3 weeks ago in Berlin. I know Berlin, I have a gallery in Berlin. Berlin is a great place with a lot of energy without any collect. No, you go to Vienna, it's a rational place, and you have a lot of collect. I still believe, supporting what you say, but also what I say, that a small galleries, which I know in Cologne, in Europe, which are really tiny galleries, a room which is a quarter of this, they are not people, it's true, they are not tired. So they go to the art fairs. There is a great art fair in Brussels, which is very selective, which you have to be admitted only by another gallery from local gallery.
XX?
In Brussels.
Oh, in Brussels.
It's extraordinary galleries. Why? Because it's controlled, the quality, by the people who are in Brussels. So they don't let people go in. You cannot go in even if you pay. There are a lot of places that if you know where to go as a young gallerist, and you have prices which are not very... I'm not talking about the start places of New York, $300,000 for a photo. I'm talking about a normal market. These galleries work very well in three art fairs during the year. They trade, they do secondary market, they show new artists. I still believe that always has been difficult. In the time of Picasso, there were this bunch of people putting money together in 1911 to buy a group of paintings of the Cubism and sell it 10 years later. The strategy is change for the art, it's change for the galleries. I think Philadelphia has possibilities. And these possibilities didn't appear yet because somebody has to come to be the first. Always is somebody who's the first in every city. The fact that you mentioned is true. Rents are very cheap. To pay a loft in New York, in Brooklyn, is $2,000 to $3,000, a small 1,000 square feet. You can get an enormous place here for $500, enormous, in Divide. This is great. It's close to New York. New York is not, it's true, it's the market, but there are other places which are market today. You can send many places. Philadelphia, I don't know the market of Philadelphia. I don't know how it's going to be. It's not my generation. I'm not going to do that. But somebody will come here and we'll do it because Philadelphia has a possibility. Because when you have the Duchamp in the museum is doing show. The ICA, whatever I like it or not, is doing great show too. And other people are doing shows, and Richard Torch is doing some things in Arcadia. We are trying to do our best with our money here. Things are going to change. I'm sure somebody will come, open a place in the next 5 years, and be successful showing modern art.
I think an interesting thing that's happened is that one of the most vital galleries in New York is Pace Gallery. They are really the top of the heap. And they opened a gorgeous space in Los Angeles, which they closed because Arne Glimcher said the major collectors wanted to see him in New York. They sold all their things. And then if you read the paper last week, a branch of Pace has opened in Las Vegas with a show borrowed from the Boston Museum. And if that's not full circle, I don't know what it is.
And also the collectors traveled a lot. What you talk about is a phenomenon which I knew in Europe, people who is faithful to the dealer. These collectors I'm talking, they came to Philadelphia. I'm going to see them in Venice, I'm going to see them in Basel. They go and they buy all over the world. And they go to small galleries and they buy works for a lot of money because they like the artists. They go, all the collectors I know in New York, they go to Basel, they go to Venice, Milan to see what is new. They sit on the world. People, you know, they get convinced, but people want to see by themselves. Sometimes with a very bad taste, and sometimes with a very good taste. It's not any more control at all. Pace, well, Pace is a, I don't know, I don't talk about Pace, I don't talk about marble, these are not considerations for me. In the world I live, these people is already nothing to do with what I expect from a gallery to be. For people like is young and is pushing. They're talking about other things. But Philadelphia has a possibility, and I believe in that possibility. I know that it's difficult, but it is also easy in many ways. If you have a backer in Philadelphia, or two backers, two collectors, who support you, you can have a gallery.
I wanted to ask if you guys can speak a little bit more about audiences. I know you were speaking about collectors and dealers, but when you guys speak of the ICA, I want you to think I mean, you augured forth images of crowds, literal, actually. But in the arts, there's always exhibits that don't get audiences. And one of the things that Philadelphia is always known for, at least to me, is this kind of idiosyncratic audience, which sometimes appears in the hundreds and sometimes it's kind of meager. And however much work you put in, it's not always predictable what that audience will be. I mean, in your years at the Academy, what were your experiences?
You know, in order to apply for grants, and foundations and granting institutions love accountability, and they want you to put down, you know, the gate. And, when you have to tell the truth, it's painful. It's painful. I mean, if you know that how many people visit the ICA in a week, I mean, it might be 200 people. For shows that are written up in the New York and reviewed in the New York Times and, you know, and so on. So that, and at the Academy, it's just unreal how few people actually came through the doors.
I think probably it was fewer in the 60s than it is now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, it's just, I mean, one of the most interesting things that happened is that, yeah, we had a street location for 50 years, and when we moved to the new location, which was the second floor of the 1616 Walnut Street building, everyone said, "Oh, how can you give up a street location? I mean, what a big mistake you're making, and you won't have anybody." I said, "Well, we don't really have anybody anyhow. It's not going to be that big a loss." And you know, I mean, the people that come to our gallery, the majority of them are in town for a convention. and they come because there are clients from other places, or they've read about us in some other source.
It's a destination.
We're a destination gallery. So we move into this building, 1616 Walnut Street, and suddenly our attendance is just, I mean, it's probably five times what it ever was. Part of it is the building that the building has a critical mass of art-related people in it, which I never thought about being a factor. But there's Fairmont Part Art Association is in the building. There's five architectural firms. There's the Fells Fund. And these people have other people that come to see them, and we're in their line of vision suddenly. 17th Street was blind. I mean, it was just a blind street. Nobody ever walked down that street. And it was just a total unexpected consequence of the move. I think that was part of it. And then part of it was adding this very young staff and their connections, and the people that they're involved with are very energetic, and they go out and they look at art. And, you know, which is what I really think having an art gallery is all about. And, you know, the selling is, you know, that's the commercial part that pays for everything. But you put up shows and nobody comes to them. It's really depressing. I much prefer having these young kids coming through and asking questions about work that we've had, that we've been showing in Philadelphia for 30 years without having much of an audience. And I think, you know, that's what we're seeing as an exciting sort of byproduct of this new influx of young people. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that in the past we could never get the educational institutions in Philadelphia to bring classes by. Mm-hmm. And now that's also changed, I think, because there's this young component that is aware of what we're doing. So that's, I see it. I mean, I see that it's not just a subtle change. It's a radically different change for us.
Thank you very much, all of you, for wonderful presentations and answers to questions. And I think it's worth going back indeed, and something we want to continue exploring, the past of the Philadelphia scene and also the present. I think it's very informative. One can learn a lot, and so I have learned a lot, so thank you very much.